Good morning. Due to the extensive length of reading today, please remain seated. I'm reading from in the Pew Bibles, most of the Pew Bibles, page 413. This is Esther, starting at chapter 5, verse 1. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's quarters while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight, and he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you, even to the half of my kingdom." And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I prepared for the king." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, that we may do as Esther has asked." So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. And as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, "What is your wish? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even up to half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled." Then Esther answered, "My wish and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and to fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Then Haman said, "Even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she had prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast." This idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. On that night, the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, "What honor and distinction has been bestowed upon Mordecai for this?" The king's young men who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." And the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, "Haman is there, standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in, and the king said to him, "What shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?" And Haman said to himself, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" And Haman said to the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and let the horse that the king has ridden on, and on whose head a royal crown is set, and let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Then the king said to Haman, "Hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave nothing out as you have mentioned." So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house mourning and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him." While they were still yet talking to him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. So the king and Haman went in to feast with Queen Esther. And on the second day, as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king again said to Esther, "What is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even up to half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." Then Queen Esther answered, "If I found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king. Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, who is he and where is he who has dared to do this? And Esther said, a foe and an enemy, this wicked Haman. Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. And the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine, as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. And the king said, will he even assault the queen in my presence in my own house? As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, the eunuchs, one of the eunuchs in the attendants of the king, said, moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high. And the king said, hang him on that. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther in the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. This is the word of the Lord. May we listen to it and obey it.
That reading was well done, Aaron. Thank you. Let me look at that. More than three chapters. Well, it happened shortly after I was converted. I grew up with a good friend who played basketball with me, and we did a lot of things together. And he took me to a camp where I heard the gospel, and I was converted. And then about a year later, I was growing in my faith, and I was learning some things, and he came over to my house. I remember where I was sitting. I remember where he was standing in an opposing sort of posture over me. And he said, you need to read this chapter. And it was a chapter from the book by C.S. Lewis called Mere Christianity. There are four sections of that called four books within it. And in the third, chapter 8, there's a short chapter called The Great Sin. It's about pride. He said, you need to read that because you have a problem with pride. And I was like, right? So I read it and I said, that's a good chapter. Actually, you have a problem with pride. Well, the truth is we both do. And that was the beginning of a journey of realizing how deep, how insidious, how sneaky is this problem of pride. In our passage today, we see one of the truths that is throughout the scriptures illustrated very clearly, and it's a contrast. The truth is this, that God opposes the proud, but he exalts the humble. It's always the case. You can see it throughout the scriptures. Our passage shows a contrast between Haman, who is the picture of pride, and on the other hand, you have some who are humble, both Mordecai and Esther. But they have different roles, and I think that's for a purpose. And then we also see the king who has supreme authority. He can do whatever he wants. And what matters is how you relate to the king for what you get, whether life or death. So in the Bible, we see this pattern of God opposing the proud but exalting the humble. And especially in the New Testament, we see this as a call for people who are Christians to renounce pride and to humble themselves. So it's not just a thing for unbelievers to get rid of. It's something that's very sneaky, pride. Pride is something that will hide and you won't even know it's there. Pride is different than other sins in that way. We're told, for example, in 1 Peter 5, young men, in the same way, submit yourselves to your elders, and all of you clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, because God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. And so we have to understand what pride is. We have to look at this passage and see, where are we in terms of this sin, which C.S. Lewis refers to as the great sin, pride. Lewis says, actually, the way to know if you're proud is to ask yourself this: does pride bother you when you see it in someone else? Does pride bother you when someone else is, they always have to talk, they always have to promote themselves, they always have to be better than someone else? If it does, it's probably because they are sort of being the king of the hill above you. Pride, C.S. Lewis says, is essentially competitive. It's not about how much you have or about what you are, but it's about having more. It's about being more. It's about beating the other person. So whenever someone else says something, you would see pride in yourself in this way: I don't have to listen to them. When you're young, it's a quick rejection of most authority. It's a quick rejection of teachers, of saying, they don't know what they're talking about. I probably know more than her. I probably know more than him. As you grow up, you'll see that this competitiveness can come out in many ways. Socially, you can see it in careers. You can see it in the way people talk and act. It's competitive in its very nature because pride is always saying, I have to be superior. And it's a very sad trap. So we see this displayed in Haman very clearly in our passage. We see a contrast with Esther and with Mordecai. The pattern of Haman's pride is reflected in what he has, and it's contrasted with what he doesn't have. His wealth is not what made him proud. His power and the glory that he had was not what made him proud. And what is revealing his pride in this is when you see where he got his sense of joy from. At the beginning of this passage, chapter 5, we start with Esther, actually, and then we get to Haman. Mordecai is at the king's gates. Last week, as we ended, remember, Esther made this commitment. She said, I'm going to go before the king. I'm going to lay down my life for the sake of my people, for the sake of God's people. And she said that famous phrase, if I perish, I perish. And that was a way of being resigned to lay down her life for the sake of others. And she did that. And whenever the chapter begins, her humility is brought out. It's actually a humility that has incredible wisdom, because as we'll see, she was playing chess. She had prayed and fasted for 3 days. But the way she comes before the king is particularly with humility. What happens here at the beginning of chapter 5 is that she dressed herself in royal robes. She made herself as appropriately beautiful as she could, and she came in before the king. She stood there, and she waited. And she was in front of the king's quarters, and while he was sitting on his royal throne, he noticed her. In verse 2, it says, when the king saw Queen Esther, now this is the point that she knew was the point where her life would either be spared or it would be forfeit. There are some things from ancient Persia, and there's one which is made out of metal, and the king is sitting, and it's sort of a side view. The king is on his throne, and there are people who come before him, and behind him, there is a man with an axe who is an executioner, and in his hand is a long, skinny royal scepter. And as you know, when Esther was approaching the king, it was risking her life. She would either receive grace with this royal scepter, or she would receive the axe from the executioner behind the king. So she came, and when the king saw her, then she was invited to approach, and she touched the scepter because he extended it to her. And he asked a question that he actually asks 3 times in this narrative over the course of 2 days, where there are 2 feasts And this is the very center of the book of Esther. It's where things change in the whole book. The king said to her this question. This is the first of three. What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you even to the half of my kingdom. Now, that's something that you've heard other kings say. You can read that inscription in other places. It's a way of bragging. It's a way of saying, I have all power. I am very generous, and I will be able to grant, because of my greatness, whatever you ask me. You're not supposed to ask for half. You're supposed to ask something that will give the king an opportunity to bestow his grace, his generosity, his benevolence on you. So, what does she ask for? Well, she asks that if, and listen to the voice that she has, it's very humble. It's very, very much underneath the sovereign rule of this king. If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king. And then the king sends for Haman. Now, Haman has been a rising star in Persia. Haman is the number two in authority. He has the signet ring that is the authority of the king of all Persia, this massive empire. And now he's invited in with the queen and the king at a private banquet. And from his perspective, he loves it. And you can hear in his voice how he swells with pride. They go to the banquet together, and the king asks that night, the first night, for the second time, what is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled. And she pauses. Now again, she's not playing checkers, she's playing chess. Because she knows this big situation. This is a massive ask that she's going to ask of the king. So she puts it off, and she keeps someone there. She keeps Haman with them. If it pleases the king, and she asks again, King and Haman, come to the feast that I will prepare for them tomorrow, and then I'll answer your question. Then I'll do as you have said. And so Haman, what's his response? You might think he would say, why am I invited to this private party? It should be a private get-together. It's the king and the queen. It's a husband and a wife. What am I doing there? But he doesn't think like that. See, he's proud, and that makes him glad of heart. Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. He's just elated. In his mind, of course I'm there with them. They love me so much. I'm so great. And he is glad of heart. But it comes crashing down as soon as he leaves the palace, because he gets to the gate, and when he saw Mordecai in the king's gate, who neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. See, that's what pride does. Having authority doesn't make someone proud. Having wealth doesn't make someone proud. But the competitiveness and the competitive nature of it is what makes a person proud. This is something that we see, and Lewis talks about this. C.S. Lewis says, it was pride that made the devil the devil. In the book of Isaiah, there is a taunt against Babylon and an oracle that is spoken. And it says this, and historically in the church, it's understood that this is about the fall of Satan. Listen to what it says. How you have fallen from heaven, O day star, son of dawn, Lucifer. How you are cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. Above the stars of God, I will set my throne on high. I will sit on the mount of the assembly in the far reaches of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. See, that's what pride does. Pride always wants to be in charge. Pride wants all the glory. And pride cannot stand any competitors. And so it is the essential anti-God state of mind. Being proud is whenever you see someone that snubs you, it offends you. But it also offends you when you see someone else snubbing others. And you look at them and you say, how dare they look down their noses at those other people? Why? Because you know it's wrong and you're judging that it's wrong, but you're offended by the people who are snubbing and you're looking down on the people who are snubbing. And so it's a deep and it's a sneaky trap, this spiritual problem of pride. For Haman, he comes crashing down. And you can see with his emotions, and we hear his private thoughts throughout this. He's elated, and whenever he goes home, he explains to his family and his household things that they probably already know. But Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches and the number of his sons and all the promotions that he has gotten, which the king had honored him with, and how he had advanced above all the officials and servants of the king. See, he knew how to play the game, and he was very successful. He was winning at life and at politics as far as he could tell. He says, even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast prepared, and tomorrow I'm invited to go again. See, he's on cloud nine. Why? Because these are the things that matter to him, to be superior, to have glory for himself. But what brings him so low is this. There was one who didn't give him glory. It was Mordecai, the Jew, who sat at the king's gate. What was Mordecai doing? Remember, he had been clothed in sackcloth and ashes, and he was grieving and mourning and fasting. And then the man's wife, Zeresh, she said, oh, I have an idea. Make a gallows. Now, this would have been about 70 to 75 feet tall. And the Persians did this for execution. They would either attach someone to a pole and put them up in the air and let them die, or they would actually put them on a pole impaled and let them die. That would be much faster. The Romans took this and developed it into what is crucifixion. The Romans, as they did with so many things, they sort of perfected it. So this was an early form of execution that became crucifixion. And the intention is, well, you have the power. In fact, Zeresh's voice sort of sounds like Jezebel. When Ahab came home and he was whining because he wanted the land of Naboth, the man who lived there in Jerusalem, and he didn't have a way to buy it, and he said, I just want that and I can't have it. Then Jezebel took over. She said, I'll take care of this, and she killed him. See, that's what we see in pride. That's what we see with our selfishness that James talks about, actually. Because James, in the book of James, it says, you want things and you don't have them, so you murder. Now, physically, probably no one in here has murdered someone. But what do we do when someone is in our way, and they block our glory? They stand in the way of our pride. What do? We want to get rid of them. We want to eliminate them. I'm telling you, it's pride that does that. It's pride that is like the murderous pride of Satan that comes into our hearts, that comes into our minds and says, that person is a problem for me and for my glory. I will do what I can to eliminate them. And so we slander them with our mouth. Or we do things to oppose them socially, politically, in the workplace. And when we do that, we have this same spirit of Haman who wanted to just execute and murder someone that wouldn't bow to him. It's the same spirit that is in the devil. And it's the devil, it's what made the devil, this pride. In contrast, we see Mordecai's pattern of humility. He is clothed in sackcloth and ashes with fasting and weeping and lamenting. And that's an allusion or a reference to Joel chapter 2, where the people were told, God is angry. God is sending locusts. And all you can do is humble yourself and maybe, who knows, they say in Joel 2, who knows, but the Lord might have mercy. It's a way of putting yourself below God and acknowledging that he is right in all that he does. Mordecai, like Esther, was humble. And look at how they end the day after these two have to meet again. Actually, let's go back a sec, because after these things, the torment that you see inside of Haman, who is such a proud man, he's joyful when he's the king of the hill, he's tormented and he's miserable when someone else won't acknowledge him as the king of the hill. Well, the next day, Haman shows up bright and early for work. He's the first one that meets the king, and when he walks in, the king says, "Hey, I have a question for you." And as you heard it read, he asks the question, "What should be done for the man whom the king delights to honor?" And Haman, here's another time when we get to hear his private thoughts. Haman thinks first, "Oh, it's got to be me. Who else would the king delight to honor more than me? Oh, I get to write my own check. I can decide what I want." And so he says, "Oh, I know what I want." And he describes it. "I want the king. You should put on that man, king, you should put the royal robes on that man. You should put him on the royal horse with the royal seal. And someone should walk that man around the city announcing this. This is what is done for the man the king delights to honor." And Haman is standing there in front of the king expecting that it's him. And then the dagger comes. All of his pride and all of his presumption were a swelling. And a dagger comes in when the king says this, "Go and do exactly what you have said for Mordecai the Jew." The guy who sits at the king's gate, get him and do that for him. The king had to repay. It was a standard, especially in Persia, that if you did service for the king, you would be richly rewarded. It was a standard. And the king had just realized through his sleepless night that it hadn't happened. It was recorded what he did, but he was not rewarded. Now the king says, "We need to reward him." Interestingly, the contrast keeps going, because Mordecai doesn't seem to glory in it. He doesn't even seem to care. He obeys. He sits on the horse. He rides around the city. Haman has to announce this and walk him around. But Haman is miserable. And Mordecai, what does he do? He just goes right back to his spot. Mordecai returned to the king's gate, verse 12 in chapter 6. And then Haman goes home. And look at what he says. It says that Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. I mean, if you put things in perspective and you could talk to Haman, you would say, "Haman, you've got it. I mean, you've won at life. Why are you mourning? Why is this wrecking you so much?" Well, because he was proud, and the one who was his enemy did not fall before him, but he had to lift him up. Something had changed. Mordecai, when he gets home, talks to his wife, and man, she's miserable. Whew. And the wise men and his wife Zeresh say this. They say, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him." Now, that's the last recorded words that he ever heard when he was ever in his household. Now, the wife knew that Mordecai was Jewish because she said so in the last chapter. But now she's like, "Oh, Jewish? Oh, you're going down. Thanks a lot, wife." Well, this is the thing that happens. As soon as she says that, Mordecai's fall is unstoppable. Everything has changed. What God's word says is proving to be true, that God will bring down the proud. We don't know when, we don't know how, but here it has begun and it is unstoppable. Because right after that, it says that while they were yet talking with him, verse 14, The king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. This is day two feast. Haman had a busy day. He had a lot of work to do. He had to walk Mordecai around the city and lead the horse and pronounce this around the whole city. And he barely had time to get home before these strong men, these very powerful eunuchs, showed up and said, now it's time to go. And they brought him. Now, the eunuchs are very interesting in this narrative because they see everything. They know what's happening. And what you see is that they actually know right from wrong. They can spot a good guy versus a bad guy. Two of them were executed early on, but the rest, in loyalty to the king, are watching the things that are happening, and they're present for all of it. So day two of the feast, and the third time that the king says, okay, now what is it? What is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. What is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled. Okay, now it's time. Now Esther has the pieces in place for checkmate. Her enemy is there. She brought him in like a spider to a web, and now he's stuck. Haman is there at the banquet. Haman has just changed. He went from being elated to being miserable. Even his wife says so. And this is how she answered. Again, with humility, she says, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted for me, for my wish, and my people, for my request. The way she says it, it parallels the king's question, because he says, what is your wish? What is your request? And she says, my wish, my life, my request, my people's life, lives. And then she says, for we have been sold, and my people, we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now, the king didn't even know that he had signed for the annihilation of the Jewish people. When Mordecai asked, and when he had his signet ring seal it and sent by what was basically these really fast horses that went all the way across, like the Pony Express, the Persian Pony Express, he didn't even know it was the Jewish people. So it was going out, but he never had the connection. He didn't even know, because she had never revealed her identity, that Esther was of the Jewish people. But now all the dots are connected, and she stands there and connects it with what he had signed earlier. This trick of Haman. This, just sign it. These people have different laws. They don't fit with us. We need to be done with them. They need to be gone. They don't match with us. They don't fit our culture. Well, now the king says, or she says this to the king, we have been sold to be destroyed and to be killed and to be annihilated. That's the very language of the edict. So now the king is connecting the dots, and he's being shown by this humble suppliant, this woman who came before him and said, listen, king, she continues, if it was just a matter of slavery, then we would have been silent. If we had been sold as men and women to be slaves, it would not compare with the loss that the king will suffer. Now, what loss would the king suffer? 10,000 talents of silver, that's a lot of money. The king had spent somewhat more than that and had lost almost all of it from his royal treasury when he went to war with Greece and lost miserably. What was Haman's plan? His plan was probably, in the killing of all of the Jewish people across the whole empire, was to take their money and give 10,000 talents of it to the king to fill his royal treasury. And that would have been a loss for the king to not refill those. And Esther acknowledges that. She acknowledges that this will be a loss to you if you spare our lives. But the king is angry, and he loves this queen, and he knows that she is humbly appealing to him. And he says, where is he, and who is it who dares to do this? Now his wrath is exposed, and Esther doesn't hold back. You see, wisdom and humility also upholds justice, and this was her opportunity to act with that wisdom. And she says it very clearly, a foe and an enemy, this wicked Haman. And then Haman was terrified. Now, when she says this, it's over. The king walks out. Haman starts begging. You're not allowed to be within seven steps of the queen. You're not allowed to be close to a queen unless you're a eunuch, unless you're doing royal service. So the king arose in his wrath. He walked outside. Haman begs for his life, and he's bowed down, or it's hard to kind of interpret that. Like, was he begging? Was he leaning on the queen? But he was way too close. And when the king comes in, it's almost like the king needed a reason to get rid of Haman now. And when he comes in, he sees it. He has a clear reason now. Now, here's the interesting thing that you might not have picked up on. He needed to know what to do with it. And you can see throughout the whole narrative that the king needs other people to tell him what to do. And he does still. Because when he touched the queen, he comes in and he says, he'll even assault the queen in my own house. And they cover his face. And then one of the eunuchs, Harbona, one of the eunuchs that had attended the king, this guy had been seeing everything. This guy had been watching everything that had happened, and he was able to speak up. And he had a sense of the need for this poetic justice. There was poetic justice whenever Haman had to lead Mordecai around the city. There's poetic justice here as well. He said, there's a gallows that Haman just prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king. And it's over at Haman's house, and it's 50 cubits high. Harbona knew. Harbona saw it all. You know, sometimes we watch things and we know there's injustice in this world, that there's wrong, and we ask God to make things right. I think that's sort of the perspective of Harbona. In this moment, he could see how justice could be carried out, and the king is guided by someone who has knowledge much more than most. So he says, hang him on that. And the end of Haman is this poetic thing where he is the one who dug the pit, and he's the one who fell into it. He's the one who rolled the stone to destroy the Jews, and now it's rolling back on him, and he's crushed. This is how Haman ends. Pride always goes before destruction, always. We just don't know when. The crazy thing is, the scary thing is, if you look at this pattern in Scripture, many people can live their whole lives with pride, and God lets them go, and he gives them over to it. Nebuchadnezzar was filled with pride. He said, is this not mighty Babylon, which I have made for my own glory? And God warned him, and he didn't humble himself. And then it took several years. I think it was 7 years. You who are studying Daniel could tell me, yeah. 7 years before he was humbled. Well, what do we do about this? The Bible tells us that we are to humble ourselves before God. Well, how does that work? Well, we should be warned and understand how these things work. God will always bring justice according to our sin. When it comes to pride, think about this. This is a quote from John Calvin. He said, man falls according to God's providence, according as God's providence ordains, but he falls by his own fault. You see, it's a tangled web we weave. And I'm not talking about when we deceive. You sort of have to say that, don't you? When we live a life of pride, when we live for our glory, when we live like Haman, and here's the catch. Whenever I describe Haman and whenever we talk about pride, you might be like me and my good friend that I grew up with, and you might be thinking, that's a problem for someone that I have in mind, okay? If that's the case, it's pride probably in you that recognizes it in the other. Because it's one person's pride that offends another person's. How do we get free of it? We have to let God be God. We have to look to God and remember, oh, he alone is God, and I am way below him, and so is everyone else. We can be encouraged also as we look at this passage by the victory of humbling yourself under God's mighty hand, looking at Mordecai, who was completely helpless unless Esther did something, unless the king had mercy through the one who was mediating for him. But he was lifted up. He was raised up out of it. How does God do it? For us, Esther is a lot like Jesus. Esther is a shadow of what Jesus is and what he has done. She was the mediator. He was the true mediator. She risked her life. He truly laid his down. Notice this, that both Esther and Haman faced death. Mordecai faced death. When Esther and Haman did, both pleaded for their life, for their lives. My plurals are off today. At least the drums were good. What makes the difference? One was in humility. One was in pride. When we relate to God in pride, it's rejected. It leads to death. The path of pride always leads to death. And if you are a Christian, you can relate to God through pride. You can fake your humility. You can be a very religious, proud person. God has to work in our lives to humble us, to convict us by his word and his spirit. Here's the biggest obstacle to becoming humble. It's thinking that we're good. It's thinking that we can make ourselves humble. And that's the trap. You see, it's strange. We're commanded to humble ourselves, yet our best efforts at it have a way of puffing us up. Isn't that funny? It's such a trap. Just try to be a humble person, and you might end up swelling with pride in how much God must be pleased with you, with your humility. Well, what's the solution? Well, C.S. Lewis in his book, and I really recommend that. Sometimes I'll recommend whole books. This is just one chapter. It takes 15 minutes to read. I listened to it twice when I was in my early morning today. The Great Sin, C.S. Lewis. Read it. It's a great diagnostic. It's a great guide to understanding pride and the remedies for it. And he says the remedy for sin, he said he wished he had made more progress with this, but he says this. You can start with this step. By admitting that you're proud. And that's a big step, he says. It's a biggish step. So here's another question for you. Who knows what's best? Do you know? Should you be the one running the world? Or do you get all tied up with anxiety when things don't happen and other people don't do the things you want? Do you come at it with complaints? Do you become completely anxious or depressed because things aren't happening the way you want them to? Are other people in your way like that? Well, I think the only way, and I got this from Martin Lloyd-Jones, the only way to escape pride truly is by looking at the cross. That's the only way. In Philippians 2, we're told that Jesus humbled himself. And this is a picture that is the truth that Esther reflects. Esther humbled herself to go before the king. Jesus humbled himself to the very lowest place, even to the place of death on the cross. When we look at what Jesus did to be our mediator, what we see is one who turned away from selfish aim, selfish ambition. He didn't hold on to his own glory. He let it go so that he could take the lowest place of the lowest servant and die on the cross. Why? He did it for you, to be a mediator for you. You're a lot like Mordecai, who's sitting outside the gate in dust and ashes, in sackcloth. When you look at Christ, what you see is someone who says, I want to help you, and I'm going to die on the cross for you. I want to do this to take your place. Now, what could get you to let go of your priority for self, which is pride? I'm telling you, it's this. Look at the cross. The pride that you might not even know is there will melt away. You'll realize that it's a heavy weight that you've been carrying that has been wrapping you up and tangling up your whole life, always competing with other people all the time. And you'll realize when you look at the cross, when you see him, that there's someone that you can trust. You can relax with him. You don't have to strive to guard your life because he died for your life. He gave himself to give you life. What Esther did was only a shadow of what Jesus actually did on the cross. She risked her life. He gave it, and he did it willingly. Well, what's the point? You can trust him. You can say, Jesus, I need you to be in charge of my life. I don't have to make myself the smartest. I don't have to be the wealthiest. I don't have to have glory for myself. The glory belongs to you. And I can trust that everything in my life is under your control, and that's where I belong, under the goodness of you who is my true mediator. The cross invites us to be free of the burden of self. The cross is what disconnects us from our pride. It takes that spiritual sin that is so insidious, and it just gets rid of it. It's a way of looking up to God all the time and seeing, God, you are loving and you are just. And as we consider his sacrifice, I just want you to ask this question of yourself. Can I trust him? As a believer, you should ask that with every situation in your life. If you are not in Christ, that's the foundational question for you. Can I trust him? And if you find any pride in your life where you are resisting him, I think this is a good place to start. Admit that you've been living for yourself. Confess it. Get on your knees. Repent of it. And tell him, I have been living for myself, but I know that I can trust you. You can do this. He is a mediator and a savior who is able to save you from your pride, which will bring you down like it brought down Haman if you hold on to it. But if you will let go of it, he will give you life. He will bring you out of the hell of yourself. He will give you a freedom that you've never had before, and you'll be able to walk in humility, with joy, with freedom, because he's God and you're not. And that's a very good thing. He humbles us, and he calls us to continually humble ourselves. He calls us out of our pride, and he calls us to do this by looking to Jesus, turning to him, and putting our whole lives in his care. Let's pray together. Our Father in heaven, we thank you for how you work through your word and by your spirit. And I pray for everyone here today, Lord, as much as perhaps we have wrestled against pride in our own lives, Lord, bring that to mind again. Help us to bring that to the light and to put that to death and to put it away from us. Lord, for anyone who is in the hearing of this, your word today, who is perhaps convicted for the first time of pride, of this terrible sin that made the devil, Lord, hear their prayers, forgive their sin, bring them out of that darkness into the glorious light of your beloved Son. We ask in his name, amen.